All right, everyone. Welcome back. This is Ryan Selkis, and you're listening to Mansari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I interview crypto's top builders, investors, and personalities to discuss the key trends in the industry. You can discover more about Mansari at Mansari.io. But for now, let's get right into the episode. It's going to be a good one.
Save money this tax season with Luka Tax, the only tested crypto tax software. Luka's listened to your feedback. Now you can calculate capital gains and see the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to access their detailed tax reports. Luka supports unlimited transaction uploads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refund. Luka Tax wants to help Mansari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MansariTax and you'll get $5 off the normal price of $39.95 when downloading today. Go to LUKKATAX.com and save money this tax season. Have you seen what the Crypto.com team's been up to lately? Talking about the MCO Visa card. It's a beautiful metal card you can top up with crypto and spend anywhere Visa's accepted. You get up to 5% back on all your spending, plus 100% rebates on Spotify, Netflix, and now Amazon Prime Travel. How about unlimited airport lounge access and interbank exchange rates? So many perks in just one card. You can download the Crypto.com app and reserve yours today.
This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io and you will not be disappointed.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to Mansari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2BitIdiot. I have another special guest today, Renee Reinsberg, who's the founder of Celo. We're going to talk about Celo, the global stablecoin project that is eating Libra's lunch. We'll see if we can trip up Renee and get her to say something explosive about that rivalry. But in all seriousness, we've got a lot of ground to cover in terms of emerging market currencies, the digital dollar, the impact that coronavirus and some of the relief efforts are having on their business, if at all. And generally where they're excited to see the stablecoin market evolve. And whether that poses a threat or an opportunity for additional growth with Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other more volatile crypto assets. But Renee, before we get into all that, why don't you just give the quick origin story and how you first got into crypto, what led you to the path that you're on today with Celo?
Awesome. Well, thanks, first of all, Ryan, for having me. It's great to catch up. How did we get into crypto? Sepp, Merrick, and I, who were all co-founders of Celo, we actually met at MIT, and Merrick and I had started a company out of Tim Berners-Lee's lab. This is 10 years ago, where Sepp ended up being our first advisor and later board member, and over the years has become a really close friend. And, you know, I think there are a lot of similarities between the conversations we've had in these early days, at MIT around kind of the semantic web and linked data and, you know, the decentralized systems and infrastructure and what a decentralized Facebook could look like, not to kind of go right there. But, you know, that was something that when we, we sold Loku to GoDaddy and spent some time there and then went back to the drawing board. When we kind of looked at what had happened with Bitcoin and Ethereum and smart contracts, digital assets, was like, wow, this is like, you know, a lot of the same concepts apply, but there's a real strong ecosystem forming very quickly here. And, you know, I think you could sort of even, you know, 2.5-3 years ago, you could sort of see that this was just on a very kind of fast trajectory. And so for us, that was really exciting because I think with every technology, you know, you need sort of that type of kind of movement and forward movement really to bring kind of change. And so for us, we started particularly, you know, looking at how can this kind of enable more participation from more people around the world, and especially people that are only on a mobile phone. And so a lot of our early work and research was focused on how can we make this kind of more mobile friendly and bring the benefits of crypto to people that may only have access to the internet through a mobile phone.
Mm-hmm. Now, you raised a bit of money from Who's Who of Investors last year, but that took place before the Libra Association got off the ground. So this is like March or so, $25 million round with Andreessen and others. A lot of, you know, kind of deep-pocketed and very experienced Web3 investors. Fast forward a few months later, Libra announces its plans. How do you think about the positioning of Celo versus Libra at that point? And then, you know, let's walk through this journey, because you hear about startups, you know, getting Googled or getting, you know, Facebooked or Amazoned. And it basically just, it's one of the big tech giants says, actually, we're going to play in the sandbox now. So, you know, why don't you give us your lunch money and think about a different business? In theory, at least, crypto should be different. It is proven to be different in the sense that it's been tough because Facebook has been in the crosshairs for Libra to get off the ground. But what's going through your mind in June or, you know, last summer when this became public? And did you know earlier? How were you thinking about positioning Celo versus Libra?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because definitely when Libra announced, suddenly there was a lot more attention on what we were doing. You know, definitely the previous rounds we had done or the token sales we had done were mostly with people who were already looking at this opportunity, at this space, who had a kind of a thesis around, you know, digital currencies and sort of internet money, to put it in a more blunt way, and people who had been in the payment space for a long time. So, you know, Jack Dorsey, Reid Hoffman, Cortina, who started Venmo, all people who had been in payments businesses and had seen some of the shortcomings of the current financial system and were excited about, you know, crypto, and then more specifically about some of the things we were focusing on. And so what really I think changed with Libra was that there was suddenly a much broader discussion around, you know, how can this actually impact, you know, there was a lot of talk about how this may help people that are unbanked or underbanked. Well, what is actually required at the feature set to make that happen? You know, what would be the user experience? What would that be kind of have to be like to actually kind of make that possible? And these were all questions that we had spent a lot of time thinking about. And in a way, it was nice because now there was much more of a public conversation happening around that. And so I feel like a lot of our work has been accelerated, mostly because there's more focus on this now. Personally, you know, and you know, I think Libra, you can have kind of your views on it. The similarities really kind of stop when you take a closer look. I think there are some kind of technical similarities in terms of like the way the infrastructure kind of is designed, and obviously there's the Libra Association, which shares some of its members with the Celo Alliance for Prosperity. But you know, I think fundamentally, I think we take a very different approach, right? This is really an open source, you know, accessible to anyone platform. So if you want to run, Ryan, if you want to run a full node or a validator, be my guest. Actually, you don't need my permission to do it. You can just do it, you know, which I think is really key. And you know, we wanted to kind of have something that can really kind of scale beyond us, and where we don't, where we're not on sort of somewhere kind of a bottleneck or in sort of a critical path, but really enable others to take this infrastructure and make it work for the things that they want to see in the world. And I think that's a little bit harder when you take a more closed approach, the way Libra has been taking it. You could argue that they don't need it because, you know, there's big distribution built into Facebook already. And so I think that's obviously also what gets people excited in terms of introducing crypto to 2-3 billion additional people. But yeah, I think fundamentally the design is quite different.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that is a little bit different is the integration that you have with being able to interface with people's phones. With the stablecoin market, I think you can't really compete in terms of the economics of the stablecoins themselves. At least, you know, from my perspective. But I want you to chime in if you think that's wrong. Instead, it's what is the tooling and how do you actually build up a flywheel so that people are using your particular stablecoin. These look like interchangeable assets, even if the networks aren't necessarily interchangeable. Can you just talk a little bit about how you position yourselves versus USDC and Paxos and Tether to a lesser extent, and all of these other stablecoin initiatives that are already underway, you know, some of which are much more liquid, much larger at this point than your project, which is just getting off the ground.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think they're kind of maybe like a two-part answer. First, if we look purely at sort of the existing stablecoin market and, you know, stablecoins pegged, for example, to the dollar, I would argue that the use cases today are still very much limited to, you know, institutional use cases, right? We don't see very many people making peer-to-peer payments in DAI or USDC. And I think some of it has to do with there just not being kind of an easy kind of way to transact, for example, on a mobile phone, right? And so to us, really, I think there's two components. There's even with sort of the existing dollar-packed stablecoins, just extending the market, right? Really starting to see a lot more of the, you know, retail use cases and consumer use cases, both in terms of plain payments, but also in terms of the kind of DeFi applications that for a large part right now, I would argue are, you know, is still, you know, a few thousand people that maybe were early adopters in Bitcoin and ETH that end up amounting for the bulk of transactions there versus people that may actually, you know, the ones that we're all talking about in terms of needing access to a better financial system. And so I think that's kind of the first step is to just making something like USDC, right? Or like really like something like a stablecoin accessible to everyone with a phone. And that's kind of a key premise behind Celo. The second piece is that, you know, in our design, we actually, longer term, we foresee a rich ecology of currencies. And those could kind of, you know, mirror some of the existing currencies, fiat currencies we have, right? So bring sort of a dollar, euro kind of into the digital world. But also, you know, we see the creation of functional and local currencies. And there really is a richness from a, you know, a vision perspective that we hope will take place where we suddenly have currencies that complement our existing currencies and can lead to more of a, you know, a world where sort of the communities are more in tune with their currencies, and currencies can actually further community causes. And, you know, I think there have been a lot of experiments and implementations of local or functional currencies, but for the most part, their scale has been limited by just not having sort of a technology backend to kind of enable that. And so for us, really, I think it's interesting to think about, okay, could this new infrastructure enable those community and functional currencies to happen at a much larger scale. The other piece to that is that, you know, this is a big debate now with COVID-19 and relief payments, you know, central bank digital currencies, the digital dollar. I mean, it's a discussion that's happening around the world at central banks and governments. And we early on, you know, recognized that, look, this is an open infrastructure. And yes, we would love for this to be the infrastructure that central banks launch their retail central bank digital currencies on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the criteria that we kind of, you know, optimize for from a design perspective are ones that, you know, central banks would care for in the same way, right? I mean, for something to be used on a mobile phone, if you think about a retail central bank digital currency, is obviously also very important. And so at a high level, I think the current kind of stablecoin market, as big as it is, I think is only a fraction of what this market can be. And in mm-hmm. terms of the use cases, in terms of the type of currencies we'll see, I think that's really about to explode and expand quite significantly.
You know, the institutional use case, in many respects, is a hell of a lot easier to make the economics of that model work, because there's embedded compliance costs in know your customer and money laundering provisions. And so, you know, the trade settlement application, which really is the 1.0 use case for stablecoins, makes sense, because even in a low interest rate environment, you can still make those numbers work. The compliance overhead is significantly reduced, or it's kind of pushed out to the exchanges who are to do this. That's not necessarily the same with a retail-focused stablecoin. So it's got the feel-good pitch, but there's this practical element, which is very challenging. How do you solve for that dynamic? And is there a way to kind of stay under the radar or stay under certain compliance thresholds just because you ostensibly are building to move smaller amounts of money around? I'm wondering if it even matters because, you know, from what we know in the West, especially, it really doesn't. Although the penalties are a little bit less steep if someone's sending, you know, $20 for a street corner purchase of something that isn't FDA certified versus someone that's trying to move kilos across, you know, a border, which is probably when you'd use Bitcoin or some other, you know, asset like cash. How does that, you know, component of the system work? Is that also pushed out to the edges? How do you think about that from a protocol level?
No, this is something we've been thinking about from day one. I think it's very clear to us as a team that, look, if this is going to be successful, it has to be, you know, in compliance and in, you know, in working with regulators, and that's at a global level, right? I think what's really interesting, though, and this is kind of to your point around the use cases here, when you look at, for example, peer-to-peer payments and, you know, much smaller smaller payments in a community, the kind of the regulatory frameworks that apply, you know, can be different, right? I think a really interesting example for that is when you look at what's happened with mobile money, for example, in Africa, in parts of Africa, where the KYC requirements for very kind of small amounts, small transactions, you know, is a lot lower than the KYC requirement for a bank account in the US, for example, right? And obviously that changes with kind of as amounts get bigger and as transactions get bigger. But I think that was purposely done to achieve more financial inclusion, right? And so I think with every kind of regulatory framework, you know, you need to kind of think about, okay, what are the benefits, but also how do you prevent bad behavior? And so I think our role as a you know, as an actor in this ecosystem is to help shape that regulation and help make this better and make it more appropriate with respect to these new technologies. I do feel we have an obligation here to have a voice and have a seat at the table. And at the protocol level, I think there are things we can do, but ultimately, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the access points, it's the applications that will and have been responsible for ensuring proper compliance. And so our perspective, you know, with respect to the underlying infrastructure, where we're constantly kind of thinking about, okay, what more can we do to make that easier, to enable that, to prevent sort of bad actors from coming on the platform. And I think that's, you know, I think the technology is neutral, right? So I think it's all about kind of figuring out kind of the guardrails of how it's being used. Mm-hmm. One other thing I would point out is that, and maybe this is where what's happening right now with kind of relief payments is interesting. You can see how people, you know, I think generally that debate is not an easy one to have, right? Because we have rules and regulations that have been in place for a long time that, you know, made sense given the way kind of things used to work. But you're seeing it today, right? You're seeing it if someone will have to wait, you know, 3 weeks for kind of a relief check to arrive, right? Or may have to wait months for getting a relief payment, where with, you know, a technology like Celo, I could literally kind of make a payment, you know, to you within seconds, and you would have it on your phone. You could go to a store and pay for it, right? So obviously there are trade-offs that come with that. And so it is, it's important to not just kind of take this lightly, but I think the technology advantage is so clear, and not just specific to Celo, but this is kind of, I think, applies to the space more broadly, that we do need a different way to look at this from a regulatory perspective. And, you know, we've been engaging regulators, and we have a team internally that's doing that. We've also brought people over from the US Federal Reserve who are thinking through kind of this, you know, how does this work in the context of central bank digital currencies? And, you know, I think, you know, we're small, but we're very excited to be to provide sort of input to that debate and provide education where possible to make a case that, you know, if we give this technology more room to grow, it can actually really significantly improve financial inclusion, even in places where that's maybe not kind of topic number one.
Mm-hmm. You can talk about the competitive positioning of different stablecoin projects. You might have a head start in this particular, I won't call it niche because it's, you know, there are many different, you know, currency applications that are massive. Ultimately, you know, I do wonder if you'll have all these different dollar-backed or fiat currency pegged stablecoins that serve different verticals and kind of win different developer audiences, or if there is some type of convergence on one single asset, or at least one underlying protocol. So I think, you know, we're just going to see how each individual asset ends up, you know, shaking out and how those are created and redeemed over time. But what about the underlying protocol that's actually facilitating these transfers? So you guys are building your own blockchain, right?
Yeah.
Talk about the design decisions there and ultimately how you view network effects in a world where Libra will probably eventually launch. There are, you know, dozens of other, you know, central bank issued digital currencies and other stablecoin projects that are built on Ethereum. Some are even getting built on Bitcoin and Tezos and all these other much more dynamic protocols. It does seem that Celo for the foreseeable future will be stablecoin focused. So does that unnecessarily limit the reach that you could have with the protocol, and what does that mean for the asset?
Yeah, no, it's thank you for asking. Yeah, we're very focused obviously on these kind of financial use cases. And so that's kind of where a lot of our focus, and this is where a lot of the communication is kind of aimed at. But, you know, really, you know, anything you could build on Ethereum, you could build on Celo kind of theoretically, right? So there's not necessarily that kind of limitation, though I will say that a lot of the features of the underlying kind of core infrastructure are specifically aimed at enabling a better experience around these financial kind of use cases. And so to give some examples, you know, obviously, you know, as you know, Celo is proof of stake. And so it has fast finality, faster block times. It has a lot of the kind of nice decentralization features right from launch. And so, you know, while it has the EVM compatibility, and so, you know, has sort of the benefits for someone who's built on Ethereum to be able to build on Celo easily. It is a proof of stake network. Mm-hmm. We have two kind of core protocols, one around lightweight identity and one around stability, that enable things that we feel are very important for any financial use case that you may be looking to kind of build. So if you think about, for example, kind of any lending use case, this notion of kind of a credit score is obviously very important. If you want to kind of move from a collateralized to an under-collateralized or non-collateralized kind of loan world. My co-founder, Sepp Kambar, actually is the inventor of Eigentrust, which is a kind of peer-to-peer reputation algorithm that we look to leverage to create sort of a concept of reputation, of sort of a credit score, lightweight credit score in this new digital world. And that's particularly important in places where there is no credit score, even no real credit score, right? So I think what will be really powerful is to kind of start seeing a basic payments network on top of which you can bootstrap a credit score and do it in a way that is kind of consistent with sort of the principles around kind of individual kind of privacy and what's being shared from a data perspective. Mm-hmm. I think the second point here is that I don't necessarily I actually agree with your assessment. I could see other stablecoins launch on Celo, right? I think, you know, I could see some of the existing stablecoins, say, hey, you know, Celo infrastructure actually works better for what we're looking to do, or we want to make sure that people who want to access this through a mobile phone, and Celo is the best way to do it, right? They have access to our stablecoin, so we're going to launch it on Celo. And so I very much agree. Ultimately, it will come down to some of the core protocols. I don't think it's a winner take all. I think there will be at least a handful of protocols that are all kind of slightly different in terms of the feature set and work well for certain areas, for certain use cases. And already now there's, you know, big efforts underway around interoperability between these protocols, and something that we've been very involved in working also with some of the other layer ones out there. So my view here is that right now, it's actually all much more collaborative, right, as an ecosystem than it's often portrayed from the outside. And we're all kind of looking at ways to, you know, make this an ecosystem that actually is interoperable and that kind of allows people to kind of seamlessly kind of go between chains. In our case, yeah, look, we're very focused on mobile. We're very focused on payments use cases, particularly in developing markets. You know, we believe if we can do a good job there, if the infrastructure works well there, it will work well everywhere. So that's been our starting point. But longer term, I think that, you know, it's really there, you know, we're not discriminating against any use case. If someone wants to build a game on Celo, you know, that's great.
You know, one thing that strikes me more recently, pretty much every infrastructure company is a multi-blockchain compatible company. You have to be, just for survival purposes. And because of that, it makes it much easier to onboard the next incremental project, because you've already built systems to monitor different types of blockchains, to plug in different types of blockchains. You have a roadmap, you have a clear kind of testing plan in place, and there are you know, economies of scale to those processes. On the other hand, you can't just be kind of indiscriminate about what you add support for. So, you know, I'm curious, on the one hand, barriers to scaling come down quite a bit because there's not as much a moat around compatibility with all the different developer tools and kind of user tools out there. On the other hand, there might be openings for teams that are more agile or have more sophisticated dev tools or documentation or whatever it may be, to give those critical ecosystem providers a little bit more comfort around, you know, making the leap and taking on the additional support burden and actually, you know, essentially taking a flyer on the success of the project. What do you think your team got right to get to, you know, 50 partners and to actually be able to launch with at least teams that were willing to put their logo aside the project, yeah, right? Yeah, there's no financial commitment like Libra, but these teams are taking, you know, putting their reputation online, saying, yes, we're going to support this. They're not just going to backtrack in 99% of cases, unless it was something structurally wrong with you know, tech.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a real commitment, right? And obviously, yeah, we don't force people to run validators or make a financial commitment in terms of buying into this, because we believe that if that's something, I mean, that's something people may do naturally. And so we actually, there are many Alliance members who will likely run validators or hold Celo Gold, right? Just as part of being a member of the community. But I think what's more important to us when we kind of started formalizing this, and, you know, we've engaged a lot of these organizations from the very early days to get feedback on the challenges, problems they were having using existing infrastructure, right, around some of the use cases that they were energizing. And so for us, it was really more now at this stage with the Alliance getting a commitment, like, yes, I will put resources behind integrating Celo, making Celo better, making Celo work well for this particular use case. So if you look at Grameen Foundation, for example, who is one of the biggest microlenders out there, they're really interested in exploring how could this kind of open infrastructure make microloans better, more accessible, right? There may be kind of new formats that they're trying out. So there are real teams, there are real people kind of spending time on this. So there is a resource commitment in that sense, but it's much more geared towards the actual application, the actual use cases, and working on something and growing it. And I'm a big fan of that. I think, you know, longer term, like if I look 5-10 years out, I would imagine that most of the development on even some of the kind of deep down kind of in the stack kind of core infrastructure will be done by engineering teams, at the various alliance members. I think Square, actually Jack Dorsey at Square, I think is a great example of, you know, spinning up a crypto team and contributing to Bitcoin and Lightning, right? I think that's something that I think will be the norm in 5-10 years. I think all technology companies will have teams contributing to these kind of new open protocols. So I think that's one thing. I think we got a little bit lucky, I think, with sort of the focus on mobile. I think that was really a gap in the existing ecosystem. And so even now we have the team who ran Libra Camp actually decided to now run Celo Camp. And we just on April 10 closed applications. And I think we had close to 250 teams applying for that, which is phenomenal. And I think a big part of that is really, you know, some of the, you know, features, the nuances around, okay, here people can, we have an SDK that lets people build native applications, right? Which for all of us who've been in the space and have, fiddled with MetaMask in a browser, we know that's not something that is likely going to get, someone who's new to crypto, it's not something that's going to go over too easy from the user experience. And obviously all these things are getting better, but I think really thinking about, okay, you know, how does an experience in the space can be as good as a Web2 experience? I think that's kind of the bar that we want to set, and that I think a lot of the either alliance members or Celo Camp participants or people who generally kind of have been following and been involved in the project are excited about.
Mm-hmm. We touched on central bank digital currencies at least a little bit. You know, when you're talking about emerging market support, you're going to be talking about territories that are not necessarily as friendly to experimentation, might be overtly hostile to any, you know, either Western influence or tech-driven influence. We'll take just the case of China, right, which is the largest market. They're going to be rolling out their own, electronic payments system and digital yuan. You'd imagine that, you know, maybe Bitcoin's okay, maybe these other crypto commodities are okay in the eyes of the Chinese government. But as soon as you start to have leakage out of the kind of core central bank digital currency, you're going to start running into problems. So do you geofence users in certain regions? Do you think about interoperability with these, you know, CBDCs? And I bring up China because they seem, out of most of the major governments, to be the ones that will move the fastest on this. So it's less about picking on them and more about, you know, this is probably the first instance that you're going to have to deal with in terms of interoperability or support, or just thinking about whether you even bother spending any time there.
Yeah, I mean, so interoperability to other systems like central bank digital currencies is a big topic, and it's something that we spend time on, and we will provide an increasing amount of resources so others can do that. And it's really, yeah, in our case, you know, as a team, how much are we going to be involved in that versus someone who is in a market or, you know, in sort of the ecosystem that will have a need around that. So I think we want to kind of have that sort of on our radar and know that that's something that would be potentially interesting to folks in the ecosystem, and make sure from an architecture perspective that's feasible and the kind of right components can be kind of on its way or can be in place. But yeah, personally, as sort of the kind of C-Labs team, it's not kind of immediate focus. I will say that we're we're seeing this maybe not yet with central bank digital currencies, but certainly with teams in the ecosystem that are integrating or building bridges to even the traditional kind of financial system. So for example, we have a company in Kenya that's built and that just launched in beta a kind of a bridge between M-Pesa and Cello. And so allowing people to kind of go back and forth from their M-Pesa account to their Cello account. And so that's, to me, it's fascinating because it's something that obviously provides high utility for people in that market. It's something that I think is great. It really, it helps sort of end users. It's not something that I would have seen our team be able to kind of dedicate resources to in the short term. And so it's nice to see some of these things being already energized by folks in the ecosystem. And so similarly here, I think there is a path where some of that may happen a lot faster, but it's not necessarily going to be driven by us, but by others in the ecosystem. So generally with respect to central bank digital currencies right now, this year, for the rest of the year, so on our roadmap, we're spending just a lot of time putting together educational materials, helping provide more information to the central banks that we're talking to governments around the benefits of central bank digital currencies and sort of different kind of infrastructure, kind of architecture decisions that could be made and help things through. Okay, how can we kind of take a step forward in that direction? And what are some of the experiments, pilots that folks may want to run? And you know, on that we're not doing this alone, right? So we're working with a lot of the kind of bigger associations that work with central banks or international organizations, and folks at the World Bank and IMF that have those conversations on a regular basis. And it's a collaborative effort. And, you know, we're certainly not the only kind of blockchain project that's pushing the ball forward on that front, but it's something that, you know, definitely we know is going to happen. And so we want to be just a thought partner as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. So first off, I love the tagline you have on the homepage. Let's make money.
it's, you know, there's a word that rotates through that.
No, I know. It's very clever. Let's make it accessible. But it disappears. It disappears for a while.
That's pretty funny. I hadn't thought about it that way.
It's good. It's subliminal. So there's like plausible deniability, right? It's not like, hey, you're going to get filthy fucking rich, but really you are. But there's other things too. You know, it's really well done. But the you know, so as people, you know, look to get involved, you're a few months away still from mainnet, still going through security audits. And do you have a kind of target date for mainnet launch, or at least the first phase of mainnet?
Yeah, we're pretty much there. So we all the audits are completed. We just kind of in the last few days stood up a kind of a dry run for what will be mainnet. And so in the coming weeks, we'll have a release candidate that will become mainnet over time, assuming that everything kind of goes smoothly. So at this point, I would say we're just a few weeks away from mainnet being live, which is really exciting. And you know, unlike a SaaS launch where you push a button and the app is live, you know, obviously here there's a series of steps that it takes before the assets start trading on exchanges and so forth. But we're in the very final stages now, which is great. And you know, I think especially with the current situation and crisis, I feel the team has really been leaning in, and same for our kind of collaborators in the alliance. I think the need for an infrastructure like Cello is bigger than ever, and with that, I feel everybody is kind of stepping on the gas and you know, working even harder and trying to kind of get this out faster. And our hope, I think, collectively, is that you know, this can become a part of the solution, and you know, it's something that could be used even in the near future. And so it's been a crazy time, but personally very rewarding, because you know, I think it's a lot of things, you know, like cash transfer programs, things that we've talked about for a long time, but now it's really, you know, it's hitting home, you know, it's being discussed in Europe, in the US. And so it's, I think it's an interesting time for the space.
This year, especially, stable coins have just absolutely taken off in terms of size and volume. We're now over 8 billion for the first time in terms of total dollars secured. Do you have any targets for both Celo Gold and for Celo Dollars at launch? Is there kind of a target liquidity pool that you will go live with? Or how do you go from zero to launch practice?
Yeah, so unlike fiat-backed stablecoins where you have like a fiat reserve here, the circulating supply in stablecoin is fully programmatic. So it's really dependent on the demand. And the protocol will kind of programmatically kind of mint new stable coins and then buy back Celo Gold, which is the reserve asset, into the reserve. And ultimately there's a mechanism to diversify that reserve with other crypto assets. So if we look kind of maybe a year out, right, a lot of that will depend on the use cases. It will really depend on, okay, are there people that are using Celo Dollars for cash transfers? Are there people looking to run UBI programs or use this for remittances or microloans or allowing people to earn this currency for work they're doing online, right? So really this is where the success of the platform or the scale of the platform will depend on all of these use cases that we've been experimenting and testing and now can actually take to kind of scale, right, from a smaller scale. So that's really what will drive it. So we're not necessarily, you know, the way you would do it with a fiat-backed stablecoin, saying, hey, we're just going to take $10 million, put it in a bank account, and issue 10 million digital coins against that. But mm-hmm. It's much more driven just by supply and demand. So, and conceptually, a lot more similar to Maker and DAI in that way, even though the mechanism is different, of course.
What is your metric for success then in kind of the first 6 months post launch? Is it to get to DAI levels and is it market cap or volumes that you're trying to optimize for out of the gates?
We have some targets. I think these are obviously C-Labs targets, and then, you know, Alliance members will have their own targets, and we have some kind of idea for overall for the ecosystem what this could look like. But I think most importantly is really around product market fit for these various use cases, right? I mean, really making sure that this is the best digital currency for cash transfers, for microloans, for remittances, for, you know, the ability for people to kind of, you know, pay on their phone or earn money for doing work online, right? So it's really more across sort of the different use cases that are energized by the various Alliance members, making sure that this is the best possible option for that. And it also means saying no to stuff, right? I mean, it means there are definitely areas where we're early on saying, look, this is not something that we'll be focused on, that over time could come, but, you know, this is not kind of on sort of critical paths to kind of the mission that we've set out. So look, I think you know, it's a lot harder to predict because we're not, it's not simply saying, oh, you know, Tether is X and we think we can be 20% of Tether within X, you know, X months, right? It's not as simple, because really it's going after a lot of new use cases. It's really kind of growing actually the market size for stable coins around a bunch of new applications. So for us really it's proving that this can actually be useful without sort of external incentives. Let me put it that way, right? I think it's what you sometimes see in this space is like, oh, you know, we're blockchain X is used for this application, and you know what ended up happening is it's just a lot of money being thrown at it, right, to kind of write a case study. And here what we're really curious about, and I think where we're aligned with the Alliance members, is this really has to, from a technology perspective, make a business case, right? If it can't, mm-hmm. then like, let's not waste time on it, right? Let's just use whatever system we're using. Like really, I think if there's no clear, step up from what we're currently doing, just on a pure technology basis, then, it's not worth kind of the investment. And luckily there are a lot of different use cases and areas where it's very clear that this can be a 10x improvement. And so focusing on those and making those happen, even at a small scale early on, but to kind of paint the picture of what this could become longer term.
Which use cases in particular are you most excited for out of the gates? You mentioned a few, cash transfers, remittances.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that everybody talks about. You know, microloans are probably the ones that I am most excited about and see the most promise because no one has been able to figure that out yet. But I'm curious where,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely having spent time sort of in the small business space and knowing how hard it is, even in the US, to get like a small business loan, for example, right? I mean, this is definitely like if you bring this to developing emerging markets where, you may have access to kind of the local loan shark who offers you a 20% monthly interest rate loan, but mm-hmm. This could really be a massive enabler, right? Just in terms of creating a kind of global, more transparent kind of market for capital. Personally, I'm very excited about the ability to earn digital currency for doing work online. You know, one thing living abroad and in many places that I think is a little bit underappreciated for folks in Europe or the US is that, for most of us, PayPal kind of gets the job done, right? You do something, you buy something online, or you do online work and you can sort of cash in, cash out with a PayPal account or credit card or whatnot. But if you're in many places around the world, right, that's not really an option, right? And so even though you have access to the internet and you have access to all the information, you're really not participating in the global labor market, right? Because you're not actually able to do work and get paid in something that kind of you can then bring into the local context and use. And so I think to me personally, that's an area that I'm pretty excited about because we can, with micropayments, kind of make micro work much more accessible to people around the world. And from there kind of really include a lot more people in the global kind of labor market. And so that, I think it's also like Celo, is Esperanto means purpose. One of our values is to really help people find and achieve their unique purpose. And, while our mission is there's a part in there, which is around a better financial system, it's really kind of what for it. And it's for kind of helping people achieve prosperity, is helping people get that sense of purpose and achievement. And so really the better financial infrastructure really is just kind of a means to an end in that way. Right. And, just creating better financial tools for the purpose of doing that wouldn't be half as rewarding as actually kind of seeing people now having participating in something, being part of something, being able to do work and getting paid for that. I think that's personally what's most exciting here.
Well, that's as good a place to end as any. Renee, how can people learn more about Celo and find you on Twitter?
Yeah. So our website, Celo.org, has a lot of information, also linked to our blog and, further documentation, all our kind of social kind of links. We're very friendly team and community. So definitely for folks who haven't been engaged yet, feel free to reach out and we'll be in touch. We always like to have new folks join the community. So yeah, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining. And for everybody that's watching and listening, thank you. Until next episode in 2 days or 4 days, depending on when exactly this goes out, sometime in the next couple of weeks. We will see you soon. And in the meantime, stay safe and be good. Thanks, everybody. And thank you, Renee.
Thanks, Ryan.
Until next time, peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot if you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.